reading of the biblical scroll. And as I reread the Megillah in preparation for this holiday, I began to puzzle over a question of motive. What was the reason for Haman's sudden, rabid, uncompromising hatred of the Jews? Why did he suddenly become such a bitter, hateful enemy of the Jewish people? When I looked in the medieval commentaries, I found that they, for the most part, passed over this question in silence. They knew, or felt they knew, why Haman acted as he had, for they knew Haman. Haman was the local lord, the bishop, the king. Haman was whoever had power over their body and their soul. And they knew that this lord of theirs was poisoned by anti-Semitism, that at the least provocation, the slightest insult, for no cause whatsoever, he could suddenly banish them from the kingdom or force them to be baptized or have them killed. They didn't ask any questions about Haman's motivation because they took it for granted. And they imposed upon Haman an attitude, a prejudice, which was anachronistic to him and to his age. And Haman lived at least half a millennium before anti-Semitism was invented. Haman did not live in Catholic Europe, but in a Persia which worshipped the twin gods, Ormuz and Ahura Mazda, as they were taught by the prophet Zoroaster. Haman was not an anti-Semite, because though Jews had fought with many peoples in the course of their biblical history, though there had been, I'm sure, the usual amount of nationalist jingoism, of war-bred hatred, the image of the Jew as a satanic force had not reached into the unconscious of Oriental man. The Jew was just an enemy, as the Moabite might be an enemy, or the Edomite might be an enemy, or the Greek might be an enemy, or the Egyptian might be an enemy. Your enemy another year might be your ally. Anti-Semitism does not emerge as a force in the world until the New Testament was declared scripture by the New Christian Church. Testament, a word of God in which the Jew was accused of the most heinous of all crimes, deicide, the murder of God. And until the church fathers looked upon the destruction of the temple in the year 70 as a sign that God was continuing to punish the Jew for deicide, until the church fathers taught that if the pious contributed their share to the punishment of the Jew, they were acting virtuously according to the will of God. Whatever else he was or he was not, the motive for Haman's actions are not to be found in anti-Semitism. Well, perhaps his motives have something to do with reasons of state. After all, Haman had just been appointed as vizier of the Persian Empire, a second in command to the emperor himself. He was responsible for the welfare of the emperor and for the safety and security of the empire. Perhaps he looked upon the Jews as a subversive force. Perhaps he felt that they needed to be rooted out from within the imperial sovereign domain. Now, if this be so, the Megillah does not indicate it. The Megillah says, in fact, that in order to win over Ahasuerus, the emperor, to his way, Haman had to offer him a sizable bribe, 10,000 talents of silver. And surely if the immediate interests of the king were involved, he would not have to be bribed in order to take action against his enemy. More than this, we know from the history of the times that the relationship of the Judeans, of the Jews, to the Persian Empire was a remarkably good one. It was a Persian emperor, Cyrus, who in the 6th century before the Common Era had allowed the Judeans to return from the exile into which the Babylonians had forced them and rebuild the great sanctuary in Jerusalem. It was another Persian emperor of a century later, Artaxerxes, the emperor after whom Ahasuerus is fashioned in the story of Esther. It was this emperor Artaxerxes who had given the mandate to his chief wine steward, the court eunuch Nehemiah, a Jew, a Judean, to return with money and with authority to Jerusalem to refurbish and enlarge the temple, and in order to establish once and for all the soundness of Judean economy. As a matter of fact, the Jews were looked upon by the Persians with such favor as such loyal subjects that Jewish mercenaries were much sought after by Persian emperors. And when they could be hired, they were given some of the most delicate military assignments in all of the empire. It was a Jewish garrison at Elephantina in the cataracts of the Nile, which guarded the Persian province of Egypt against incursion from the Sudan, from Africa. And there were Judean garrisons along the passes in eastern Persia, guarding the plateau of Persia from incursion from the steppes of Asia. The relationship of the Judeans and the Jews to the Persians was a good one. And we can find no reason of state to explain Haman's activity. How then shall it be explained? If we look closely at the Megillah, at the biblical text, we find it's brief to the point of being enigmatic. We're told simply that the emperor appointed a new prime minister, a new vizier, Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and that there was a ceremonial parade at which all of the court officials bent the knee as a matter of court etiquette, showing their loyalty to this new viceroy. And Mordecai refused to kneel to Haman, but the news was brought to Haman that Haman was so angered by the news that he not only sought to destroy Mordecai and his immediate household, but all of Mordecai's people, all of the Jews. And there were many in the far-flung cities of the Persian Empire. If we read the story of the Bible without putting it in its time and place in historical form, we would be led to believe it was nothing more than personal pique and vanity that led Haman to act as he did. But one can hardly imagine a man who was a consummate diplomat, a shrewd politician, who had somehow risen through all the complex intrigue of an Oriental court, to believe that such a man would be so angered, so enraged by a single act of either discourtesy or disloyalty to his person, that he would not only avenge himself against the man who had been unwilling to do him obeisance, but against a vast people, many of whom were among the most important and significant citizens of the empire. But perhaps we shall find our answer if we consider the actions of Mordecai. Why did this Judean courtier, refuse to yield to Haman? Now, some of the early commentators, particularly in the Greek world, suggested that Mordecai acted out of religious piety. The Jew knelt in ancient times during his worship to God. Shortly after we conclude this part of the service, we will stand for the adoration, which concludes with a familiar Hebrew phrase, "V'anachnu koreim u'mishtachavim u'modim," which means literally, we bend in obedience to God, we kneel on the ground in obedience to God, and we actually prostrate ourselves in worship to God. We no longer do so. But in the ancient world, as in the Muslim world today, it was the ordinary practice of the worshiper to kneel and to prostrate himself during the daily prayer. So the argument was offered that out of loyalty to God, this pious Jew was unwilling to bow to a man, to someone who was less than God. Now, it's a noble thought. But unfortunately, from the Bible, we know that Jews had no problems in bowing down before kings. David himself bowed down, according to the Bible, before King Saul. We know from our history that Jewish courtiers and ambassadors did the perfunctory ceremonial bow to pharaohs and to Caesars and to kings of all kinds and of all stripes. They had no difficulty. And they would have had no difficulty with a Persian viceroy who was not certainly a god king. We cannot find in this pious explanation for all of its purity of intent an explanation of Mordecai's action. And the rabbis knew this, because they quickly went beyond this explanation based upon piety to one based upon the second commandment. They invented a royal uniform for the viceroy. And they said, in addition to the staff of his office, the viceroy of the Persian Empire was required to wear an icon as a necklace around his neck. And because of the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. Because Mordecai was bound by the second commandment, therefore he could not bow to the man who wore an icon on his chest. Now the problem with this explanation, which again is high-minded but false, the problem with this explanation is that in the end of the story, when everything turns out right, Mordecai becomes the viceroy. And in the tradition-bound court of the Persian, he then would have had to wear the icon of office himself upon his chest, which he obviously didn't. More than this, there's no evidence at all from the Persian annals or from the Greek travelers like Herodotus who visited the Persian court that the prime minister, the viceroy, wore an icon of some type. The point of fact, this is piety and not an explanation. What then is the explanation? We must find it by looking at the nature of the Megillah, the nature of the story itself. It's very much another of those short stories of wonder and amazement and adventure, like the Thousand and One Nights, which were beloved throughout the ancient Middle East. It is fiction and not fact. It is fiction which depends upon an agreed-upon set of symbols between the audience and the storyteller. And in this case, the symbol is signaled not by the explanation given by the storyteller, by the text itself, but by the name that the story gives to the villain of the piece, Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Haman is simply a made-up name. Hammedatha is probably the most Persian name the storyteller could think of. The scholars say that it probably comes from two Persian words, Amandata, which means the gift of the moon. It gives us very little except they give us the sense of the Persianization of the piece. But the Agagite, Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, gives away the story. Agagite, a gentilic of the people of Agag. The word Agag we know from the Bible. It's not a Persian word. It's a West Semitic word which appears very often in the biblical text and refers to the kings of a particular Amorite group called the Amalekites, who lived during the 12th, 11th, 10th, 9th centuries before the Common Era in the Negev. The word Agag means king, the way Pharaoh means king or Caesar means king. All of the kings of the Amalekites were called Agag. And to call Haman an Agagite was to call him a direct descendant of this people of the Amalekites. Now, who are the Amalekites? To us, they're a strange name coming out of Near Eastern lore. They sound like Edomites, Moabites, Amorites. We know nothing really about these people unless you go to a dictionary and look them up. But to our ancestors, the Agagites represented the archenemy. There is a three-word warning in the Bible which was familiar to every Judean. Zahor et Amalek. Forget not Amalek. Amalek, whose king was Agag, represented the enemy, represented the fiend incarnate. The book of Exodus tells us that when the Jews first left Egypt, they were hardly a day into the wilderness. They had not yet come to Mount Sinai and been given the law. At this very moment, at a place called Rephidim, the Amalekites descended upon the Hebrews who had to fight for their lives. That was the wonderful battle of which you get the image, that God allows victory to Joshua and to the host of Israel as long as Moses will keep his hands high in the air. And as the day wears on, because the battle is fierce, his hands begun to get heavy, Aaron picks up one arm and Hur picks up the other arm. They keep Moses' arms up high in order for him to be able to signal victory to the host. In the book of Deuteronomy, we have an explanation, a further explanation of this ancient enmity. But there we are told that when this original battle took place, the Amalekites, instead of fighting like men, attacked the rear guard, the women, the children, the old men, the non-combatants. They attacked without warning. They attacked without provocation. Therefore, remember Amalek. Remember the intrusion of evil, evil men into this world. The Bible concludes with an oracle in the name of God against the Amalekites. I will utterly wipe them off from upon the face of the earth. Amalek represented the dangerous, despicable, fiendish enemy to the ancient Judeans. Wars were fought with Amalek throughout the period of the Judges. The Bible tells us that King Saul fought against the Amalekites, and King David fought against them. And finally, shortly after David's time, they seem to have been finally beaten and to disappear from history. But there's another story in the Bible, rather the extension of the story that suggested the battle of Saul against the Amalekites. The prophet Samuel tells Saul that God wishes him to extirpate, to destroy the Amalekites, not to leave a single one of them alive. Well, a few times in which a holy war is proclaimed against an enemy. And Samuel recalls the treachery of the Amalekites in times past. And then Saul goes out and fights a good battle and has victory. I'm having a loss, not a victory. In any case, and then Saul goes out and fights against the Amalekites and extirpates them, destroys them. But instead of destroying all of the Amalekites, he leaves Agag alive. He allows the king his life. And in so doing, he violates the will of God, and Samuel castigates him for doing so. And obviously, the storyteller has picked on to this familiar biblical story and has said, in a sense, if Saul had only destroyed the last Agag, we would not have Haman today. Haman is the lineal descendant of these ancient, unforgiving enemies of the Jews. In other words, the storyteller suggests to his audience that Haman's actions are due entirely to his being of the people who are the age-old enemy of the Jew. And one could not expect any other kind of response by an Amalekite to a Mordecai, to the unwillingness of the Jew to bend him in courtesy to the ancient enemy. Maybe the Martians have landed. In any case, we could not assume that they could not have assumed in those days that Haman would have acted any other way than he did and the Amalekites had always done. And we could not assume that Mordecai, as a Jew, was a proud Jew, and not a pious Jew. A proud Jew would have acted any way that he could than he did. So how could a Jew bow himself to the ancient Hittites? The phrase Zachor et Amalek, remember Amalek, represented to the ancient Jew very much what the term eunuch represents to us today. It meant essentially that you cannot do business with the Haman, the Hitlers of the world, that there are evil people in this world who are beyond reason, whom you cannot offer the courtesy, whom you must simply fight to the death. As I reviewed this story, I thought of our own day. Analogies are dangerous. But nevertheless, I thought of Amalek and of Hitler in the 1930s, 1970s. In the 1930s, there were many in our world who said, you can do business with Hitler. Hitler is a product of the defeats of the First World War, the bitterness of the Versailles Treaty, the reparations. He really doesn't mean what he says about a Judenrein Germany, about a Germany from which all Jews have been eliminated. Let's give him Danzig, let's give him the Tsar, let's give him the Sudeten, the little pieces of candy that he wants. He and his people will soon be satisfied, and they'll forget their Nazi ideology. And there are people today who are saying the same thing. The Assad, the Arafat, the Faisals of the world don't mean what they say. They're not the intractable enemy. Let's give them the West Bank, let's give them Gaza, let's give them the old city of Jerusalem and the Golan, Palestinian state. They seek for the bitterness of the Palestinians, and once they have this state, all will be well with them. Now, the difference between 1930 and 1970, of course, is in 1930, the Jewish communities were dispersed. They had no national identity. They were disarmed. In the 1970s, you have a state of Israel. And so in the 1970s, you essentially have the Assads and the Arafats of the world exactly in the position that Haman was in so many millennia ago. They stand next to power. They don't have the ultimate power themselves. They must convince the Brezhnevs of the world. They must convince the Fords of the world to do their will before it can be fully done. And so very much like the Haman of ancient times, they are going about, these people, appealing to fear and anxiety and to stupidity. According to the Megillah, once Haman recognized the enemy whom his people had vowed to exterminate, the Jew in Mordecai, he sets out to destroy the Jew, but he must win the emperor's assent. So what does he do? He goes to the emperor, and he plays on the emperor's anxiety. There are people abroad in your land who aren't easily ruled. And he creates dark suspicions in the emperor's mind. And he says to him, these people will not obey the emperor's law. He doesn't give them specifics, only suspicions. And then finally he offers the most convincing argument of all, 10,000 talents of silver. Well, 10,000 talents of silver is oil, contrast. And the dark suspicions are the phrases that we hear more and more today, that somehow the Jews have an unholy control over the media of the world, and we have manipulated the news so that the facts as the people understand them are not the real facts. And the anxiety, the Jews are widely dispersed and in control of positions of power, of banks, and of other such things. And there are people who are listening. Recently, Time Life took a group of the leading businessmen of this country into the Middle East. Very proud of the fact that these business executives represent corporations which produce 10% of our gross national product. And they met with the leaders of that part of the world and were much impressed by the contracts, by the oil, by the business opportunities. That's a very persuasive argument. And when they came back, they began to go around the country. They were in Cleveland just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, speaking of the miraculous fortunes which are to be made in the Middle East. Only we have the usual American initiative to go out and to get the business. And they went further, because their hosts had played upon all of the arguments that Haman played on a long time ago. They've been told darkly of the manipulation of the American press by its Jewish owners, of the manipulation of American policy for the purposes of domestic political advantage. And they began to speak rather openly of these suspicions, these dark shadowed suspicions. The world can be bought. that the Hamans of the world discovered long since. And once you are bought, you become convinced that the man who is offering you the money to live the life of luxury, to maintain your harem and the royal expenses of the great banquet, that this man who is offering you so much is indeed one of the noble men of the earth, and his enemies are indeed the enemies of all mankind. And so Ahasuerus proclaims Haman to be the savior of the kingdom, and the associate editor of Time Life, who has been going around the country, a man named Lynn Fontenberry, speaks of his meeting with King Faisal as the most impressive hour of his life. King Faisal is a silent man, and he has a lot of oil. But he's also a male chauvinist who keeps a harem. He also is a slave owner who owns human beings. He's also an absolute tyrant who has the power of life and death over every one of his subjects. He is also an anti-Semite of the worst order, anti-Western, in that he will not accept even the building of a church, much less of a synagogue, on the property of Aramco or some of the other oil concessionaires in that part of the world. He's a powerful man, but not a nice man. Not a good man. Speak of a meeting with such a man as the most impressive hour of your life shows a remarkable lack of sensitivity or remarkable stupidity. For I suspect what Mr. Fontenberry saw in Faisal and what many of these other businessmen saw in these Arab potentates and sheikhs and leaders was not the man himself, nor the objective facts of the situation, the possible profit for their corporation. And we make saints and gods out of gold in America. Now, as you remember, the happy denouement, the happy ending of the book of Esther is brought about because Esther is a king's favorite and she reveals herself as a Jew. She exposes Haman's plot, the reason for it, and the Jews are forgiven, given their lives, and Haman swings on the gallows, he is prepared for Mordecai. Now there are no beauteous Esthers in the harems of the Middle East. And though our women are wonderful, they will not save us this time. Men and women together, Jews, must do ultimately what Esther did. Not in the privacy of the king's bedchamber, but in public. In our meetings with the non-Jew, with the business establishment, so mesmerized by the contract offered. And we must show them what they refuse to see. And force them to understand that the issue in the Middle East is not what was called by Fontenberry the inflexible attitude of the Israeli, but the fact that the Arab world will simply not permit the state of Israel to exist. There would never have been a fourth Arab-Israeli war or a first Arab-Israeli war if the Arabs in 1947 had accepted the partition scheme of the United Nations. Israel has never gone to war for territory. She's only been forced to defend herself as best she can. And what seems inflexible to these money-seeking industrialists and to the diplomats of Western Europe tilting their country's policies towards the Arab world is not inflexibility at all, but simply a statement of the necessities of survival. Without the Golan, the Galilee does not survive. Without the old city of Jerusalem, Jerusalem's a city without a heart. The West Bank or the Sinai are remilitarized by the enemy. There's not a house in Israel which is not under the enemy's gun. And the enemy has not been willing to do the one thing which would bring flexibility to the military discussions in the Middle East, and that's arranged to accept the existence of Israel in the Middle East. Israel's existence were guaranteed, the matter of borders becomes tertiary, a little matter, hardly a sufficient. Now, the lesson of Purim is that the Garden of Israel ultimately does not slumber and does not sleep, that our days of sadness turn into days of joy. There have been not only this single Purim in Shushan and Persia long ago, but many Purim for our people throughout the ages. There are some 300 known Purim, which have been celebrated by Jewish communities throughout the world at moments when they were delivered from the enemy. We will celebrate another Purim, of that I am confident. But to reach that point, there will be shadow days, days of danger. To reach that point, each of us must undertake to do what Mordecai and Esther did so many centuries ago. Stand up and speak openly and forthrightly with our neighbors wherever there's an opportunity. To force them to see the facts for what they are. It's time for going along and being agreeable and repeating the can't of the larger world is long since gone. Each of us must be an Esther or a Mordecai, making clear to those among whom we live the justice of the issue, the facts of the issue, the reality of the issue, holding up to them a mirror so that they will see the gold that glints in their own eyes and perhaps be moved to understand the ugliness, the dire consequences of some of the things that they may be saying. Will not be easy. Most of us don't like to speak what is an unpopular word or thought, but it must be done. It will be done. Of that I am confident. Amen.